Hi, I'm Steve G. Jones here with John Harry Turan, and we are talking about the magic of the morphogenic field. And we're going to look at why events that happen in one place seem to affect other events that occur in completely different areas. And you're going to learn how to tap into the morphogenic, also called the morphic field, to create success and happiness. John, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm excited to learn about the morphogenic field because I've got to admit, I don't know anything about it.
I don't think most people do. It's a little area again which ties into all the other things we've talked about, but they never looked at it this way.
Well, I hope you can break it down for us like you always do and explain it and bring that lofty information down in simple terms like you're so good at doing and explain it to us. So, first of all, let's start out with a Webster's Dictionary style definition. What is the morphogenic field?
Well, even they don't explain it sensibly. By that I mean for the ordinary person to know what it is like. But I could explain it by giving you an example of things. I love to give examples.
Okay.
Take, for example, a spider's web. There it is. Let's say it sits in this room and all the edges are on the walls. And right in the middle, there's this little spider. And anything that touches that web, no matter what part of the web it touches, the spider knows immediately some sensation or some energy or some information. I like that better here because that's one way that energy works also. Some information is conveyed almost instantaneously to the spider that it knows there's a fly. Let me go after it. And that's basically what it is. It's saying that there's a field that connects everything that surrounds us. You see, we live on a magnet, okay? The Earth is a magnet. You don't believe that? Most people don't. They don't even think of it. Just look at a compass. It points to magnetic north. People say that one of the reasons is because of the molten iron and everything else we have in the center of the Earth. And because it's spinning, it's creating a current or a magnetic field. Just like any current traveling through something does. And so we live in this field. We don't even know about it. We don't think about it. Our very cells in our bodies align themselves at times with this field, north, south. You take iron filings and you put them on a piece of paper, you will notice they turn north, south. And not only is this Earth like that, our solar system, the sun has a magnetic field and it seems to be split into sectors, like I think eight different ones. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that, but it doesn't matter. It's split into sectors. So magnetic fields affect other magnetic fields. And what are we but like magnetic beings? Because we have iron within us, we have energy, we have all kinds of stuff. So it's the ability to tap into this field. Again, the ancient rishis talked about it. They just called it the field. And the conversation in the Bhagavad Gita between Arjuna and Krishna talked about this, talked about the field. Poets like Rumi mentioned, beyond the feeling or the knowing or the thinking of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I will meet you there. So that's a rather long answer through giving an example of what we mean by the morphic field. We'll get into it in more details. Did that say anything there?
Absolutely. That opens up the floodgates of information to start flowing, and I appreciate that. It kind of gets my thought process going with a few questions. So, how big is the morphogenic field?
It's big. It's like very, very big. Not only on Earth, not only to our solar system, not only to the Milky Way, the galaxy. It seems like it reaches out to the entire universe. Naturally, we can't prove that physically, but we know certain things about this field. And this is from maybe first or second year chemistry, maybe a little bit more advanced, where electrons, we all know, or no, we all don't know, but electrons are paired. They go in pairs, or they have a relationship with another electron. And one of the things they do is they spin. And if one is spinning one way, we call it a positive half spin. And if the other one is spin, if one is going positive, the other one will be going negative. So we say the two electrons, they're tied to each other. One goes positive half spin, the other goes negative half spin. I don't want people to be confused by the nomenclature, but I need to illustrate a point. Just remember, two electrons, one does one thing, the other does the opposite. Here's the thing. They do that when they're close together. And the theory shows us, or the calculations show, if you were to move one from away from the other one and put it on the other side of the room, when, let's take the positive spin one, the positive half spin, if it changes its spin and goes the other way, immediately, like not even nanosecond, like instantaneously, the other one changes because they always go opposites. Then it went on to say, well, if one of those electrons is in this room with me and the other is in where you are, Steve, if the one here changes its spin, immediately the one where you are changes again. Then it goes on to say, let's take this a little further, see what happens. And they discovered that if one of them is here and the other one is across the world on the other side, let's say in China, and my electron changes, immediately the one in China does. And it goes to, if that electron had been on Mars, it changes immediately. Now here's a question. How does the one know to change immediately when this one changes? It's because they're connected by something. And even as, I would say, as early as the 19th century, I don't recall exactly the date, but I think it was in the 1930s, that a professor at Harvard was already talking about this field that's around everybody. Now, many people know of aura. They say, well, we have this field, this energy field around us. But I am not too certain that the aura or the auric field is separated from the entire morphic field, the totality of fields, the milieu we exist in. So we live and move and have our being in this field. We don't see it. Sometimes we have glimpses of it, but it plays an extremely important part in our lives, in knowing things. And as we go on, you'll see why.
Okay. I've been fortunately, I guess, to keep up a little bit with what we're doing, and purely by coincidence, by the way, I've been reading some books by Michio Kaku, who's a theoretical physicist who writes books about Einstein's work and so forth. Yep. And he talked about a process called entanglement. And is that the process you're describing?
Well, they're all related again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and entanglement is where something that happens with one particle affects something that happens with another particle, and distance is actually irrelevant. They could be light years apart and still in communication somehow with each other.
Yeah, it doesn't seem, it seems to, this field seems to be unaffected by space, by time. It does not consist, it seems, of energy per se as we know it, or matter. Is neither, and probably both at the same time, but it seems to have no effect, like we said about the electron. Distance did not seem to have an effect on it, and that's why many of these words, morphogenic, morphogenetic, the field of infinite possibilities, entanglement, everything else, they relay different ways of seeing the same thing. It's like seeing a movie on a DVD, watching it on your TV, or listening to the MP3 of the movie, different ways of getting the information on the same topic.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. I like it. Now, what practical use will we have for the morphogenic or morphic field?
Okay. I think everything that we go through seems to be practically affected by it. Let me give you an example. I remember that Deepak once in one of his lectures was, I used to be a guest at almost all the lectures wherever, if I'm in the same city where he is. And I remember his talking about tuberculosis and smallpox, lots of different diseases. And when someone discovered what was causing the problem, the incidence of the disease seemed to drop off dramatically just by understanding what was happening. But here's another example to show you how powerful this thing could be, and we can find ways of using it. Because to sum it up, what it is saying is very, very simple, and it really means this. It's easier to do something that has already been done, even if there's no direct physical link between the two. That means, remember, look at what happened in our history. At one point, Leibniz in Germany invented or discovered the calculus, and almost instantaneously or around the same time frame, Newton came up with the calculus in England. You look at situations with other things. The telephone. We know, of course, that it was Alexander Graham Bell, and we say he invented the telephone. But it was already worked on by other people, and about the same time it came into being. It means somehow these energies are speaking with one another. You want to know what a practical method of using this is? Let's say you're a physicist, and you want to contact the field of energy around Albert Einstein, or one of our great, let's take one who is physically alive today, one of our great quantum physicists. And we just read a little about him or her. We think a little about that person. We study a little bit of what they've been doing. Now that information will start flowing to us. And if we are aware, if we are sensitive to these things, if we have gotten rid of a lot of noise in our minds, you know, the self-talk that continues all the time and blocks out everything, then we might get that information. You see, what do you think a part of the mastermind group is? A part of the morphic field. Because when two or three or four or six people are gathered looking at the same thing, we have a strengthening of the field. And Foster Hibbert via Napoleon Hill said that the field, it doesn't double. If two people get together, it doesn't double its strength. It cubes itself. So instead of one and one, it's two. It's like two times two times two. Two people with like thoughts will have the energy of about eight people. What about three? That would be like 27. Four would be like 64. So you see the power of the mastermind. That's why everybody talk about the mastermind like it's, you know, they say the Lord's Prayer, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Have no idea what they said. Instead of focusing on what it means you're dealing with tremendous amounts of very directed energy. It is even biblical, where we found in the New Testament where it says, if two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in the middle of it. So even from mystical and religious teachings, up to the present day, we have mention about this, or like in the times of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna and Krishna again, where Arjuna says to Krishna, Lord Krishna, tell me, what is the secret? I would really like to know what is the secret. And Krishna says, you really want to know? Let me tell you. I'll tell you the secret. The secret is I know myself and I know the field and I know myself as the knower of the field. That means there's a oneness to everything. We're all one. And one part would react to the other part. It means that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, which means that if I am thinking of a problem I face right now, somewhere on earth, a bunch of people have faced exactly the same problems. All we have to do is say, hey, how did you solve that one? And like I am fond of saying, there are only three problems: money, health, relationship. Whatever it is, pick the worst problem you can think of and say, I have this problem with money. I was rich and now I'm poor. Or I was poor and now I'm rich and then I lost it and I'm poor again. And back and forth. And I want to be stable. I want to have something that doesn't spike, doesn't go higher than totally down low. No peaks and valleys. I need to know the answer to how I can build a business or a lifestyle where there is always a decent amount of income to make things comfortable to me. Now, in the middle of approximately 7 billion people, almost 7 billions of us on Earth, don't you think that maybe, just maybe, 100 of them or 1,000 of them have had the same problem and solved it very creatively? I would venture to say yes. And so if we can sit down in a moment of quietness and picture that there are others out there and feel what they are saying to us or getting the guidance from them, this is a totally different way, Steve, of explaining this stuff. Getting the feeling from them, we will all of a sudden think, oh, this is what I have to do. I'm supposed to close down my brick and mortar business and start working on the internet. Or I'm supposed to get rid of the internet thing because I don't know anything much about that. And I've been trying it for X number of years, but I always wanted to be a chef. And there was this opportunity, and I said to myself, who, me? Now, it's too late. And then a voice says, it's never too late. Look at the examples you've got. Look at a guy like Churchill, who in his, I guess it was in the 60s, led his country to victory with our help, of course. Look at somebody, the founder, Colonel Sanders, who in his 60s packed up his pans and pots and with a simple recipe went on the road, and finally today almost everybody in our country here and in almost all countries overseas. By the way, for those who are listening, we are in the U.S. right now, but I have seen Kentucky Fried or KFC in Kenya. I've seen them in India. I've seen them parts of other parts of Africa, all over Europe. So here he was in his 60s. And he did that. So the field doesn't care whether you're old or young. It doesn't really matter. The field did not care when Mozart, at the ripe old age of about 7 or 8, was playing some of the best music you could ever think of, some of the most delightful music. They said he was a genius. How do we know he's a genius? We don't know that. I don't think he took the Iowa tests. I don't think they gave him an IQ test, but he played so beautifully. What he did was he took the music of the universe and brought it through him. So you see the practical applications of knowing a little about this field.
Absolutely. Now, as we've been talking, I've been drawing a diagram for myself. And I remember from previous discussions, you talked about us tapping into alternate versions of ourselves and getting distinctions from that, getting information from that. In other words, what would an alternate version of us in a parallel universe do? And we can tap into that and get that information. So let me make sure that I have this correct here. With the morphogenic field, we can tap into that. We can also tap into other people in the past on Earth who did things successfully. We can tap into their information. We can also tap into information from people who are on the Earth or perhaps living in other galaxies or so forth, since there's no distance limitation with the morphogenic field and the information we can gather from it. Am I on the right track?
Steve, I'm always, always amazed at your brilliance. This is precisely what I'm talking about. You see, with the field just is. It just is. We can try to dissect it, we can try to analyze it, we can try to study it and whatnot, but it's the field. We all exist within it. All these alternate realities that we talked about earlier exist within the field. It's the oneness phenomenon. It is just like there is this hole, and it, W-H-O-L-E, some people might think I meant H-O-L-E. No, there is this W-H-O-L-E, this totality of everything, where I once said there couldn't be two everything, and everything is connected to everything, and there's only one everything. And so you're right. We can tap into the mastermind group. We can tap into those who exist physically on Earth today. We can tap into alternate realities. Don't you think that for one moment, and I don't mean that as you, Steve, I meant editorially to anybody, don't you think there's somebody who really, really knows how to play the guitar very nicely, very well, and could teach it very easily to somebody who doesn't know? And I'm sure that's the case. Therefore, if I want to play the guitar, which I have always wanted to but never assigned the time to do it and took the effort to do it, I could sit down and start just strumming on the strings and playing anything I could think of. And as I tapped into this field, remember what the whole thing is here. It's always easier. It's easier to do something which has already been done, even if there's no direct physical link between the two. So I will be tapping into this field and taking the information in this field, and I'll be able to play the guitar in a short while. Here's an experiment which always fascinated me. It's I think it was written in Lyle Watson's book. His book was called Beyond the Supernature, and I liked all of his books, and I think he was one of these biologists also. And he told of a sort of experiment that was run by a few scientists. What they did, they took three short rhymes in Japanese. All these rhymes had similar sound, structure, and everything else. But these rhymes were meaningless. They were jumbled. They had no meaning. So no one would be able to tell exactly what they were. Now, three rhymes. One was a meaningless jumbled rhyme. Two was a new rhyme, just absolutely new. That one had little meaning. The third was a traditional rhyme that many, many people for generations in Japan knew. So here we've got these three rhymes. One, a totally meaningless jumble. Number two, a new rhyme, which was just written for this experiment. Number three, a traditional rhyme that everybody everywhere in Japan or who spoke Japanese knew. Now, what they did is they pick a bunch of English-speaking students who knew nothing about Japanese and how it is, and taught them, you know, say, memorize these three Japanese rhymes. What they discovered was something that was amazing. They discovered that most of the students were able to memorize the old Japanese rhyme that had been around for hundreds of years, and very few of them got the other two. The thought that Watson talked about was this, or emphasized was, you know, because these rhymes were there for years, they built up into a much stronger field. So these new people who were memorizing the three were able to do this one faster and more easily because it was done before and before and before. You see, going back to what we said earlier, it's easier to do something which has already been done, even if there's no direct physical link between the two. And it applies to everything.
That's very powerful. That opens up a whole new world for learning and growing. And as someone like myself with a doctorate in education, that's the route that I've gone because I'm so into teaching NLP and teaching hypnosis these days. I thought getting a degree in education would make the most sense. So for someone like me, this has tremendous applications because this means that there's a whole a different way of teaching than what we've thought about. We've thought about every person for themselves. They've sort of got this blank slate and they've got to put stuff on it. But tapping into what other people have learned is a possibility with what you're saying.
This is the part that I think we should study more and we should use practical benefit. And yes, like in education, you probably were formally educated the way it was done before and before and before. And here are these new pieces of things coming up saying, well, you know, you don't have to use the slate and the slate pencil anymore. For goodness sakes, you don't even have to use the chalkboard. I don't know when last I saw a chalkboard, except that when I went to school, that's all they used. And they called it blackboard. These days they call it whiteboard. So there's an evolution in education. But think what it would be for the younger generation today if they knew this when they were 5 and 6 and 7 and 10. And as they go to school and say, here, there is this giant library, let's say in the sky or wherever. It exists everywhere, every time, and the greatest teachers are in there just waiting to ask me or teach me if I ask them. It seems it is necessary to ask. By asking, we don't mean shouting out, here, there, everywhere, saying, you there, help me do this. or can you please help me do this? By asking, it means having this great desire for this knowledge, and from knowledge, of course, going on to wisdom, combining the knowledge in useful ways. So you're right, in the education field, this could be of tremendous help. Think of how wonderful it is when someone can sit and out of the blue put together some beautiful poetic lines, or just paint the greatest painting, instead of just saying, I'm going to have to try to do that because I am so confused. I'm thinking, I'm painting, but while I'm painting, I'm wondering where the picture is coming from. And so you get stuck. When you realize it's coming from nowhere and everywhere, when you realize that learning isn't learning, but is just remembering, like my old friend Deepak used to say. Deepak Chopra said once to me, and you know, reflecting, he said, so much effort to learn when all we have to do is remember. And I would like to expand on that and say, so much effort to learn, so much trying to remember, when all we have to do is get quiet and become aware of the world or the universe we live in.
I think that's very well put. And if people would just tap into that, and now, thanks to you, they have the technology to do so. They understand the metaphysics behind it, which, you know, it's getting to be a thin line here between metaphysics and physics. We usually look at physics as, you know, the things we can learn in school, Newtonian physics, even the physics that that Einstein developed, and then string theory. And then we look at metaphysics as something beyond that that wouldn't necessarily be taught in school. But what I'm learning by listening to you is that if there's any distinction at all, there's really not much of a distinction.
I agree with you, Steve, and probably I wouldn't dare say that among my physicist friends, I mean the standard ones, yet, although I have found that there are many physicists who think even stranger thoughts than we're talking about right now. Those are the exceptions today. But classical physics, or what we call Newtonian physics, where the body stays at rest unless there's a force that bumps into it or something, or Newton's laws, which governed absolutely the thought of the universe as just a giant machine. And then that went on and on, and then all of a sudden we have on the scene a young man who, he was really young, and I don't know, maybe I'm sure in his 20s or even younger than that, where he walked up to the post office, a postal clerk, I guess he was at one time too, with a sheaf of papers in his hand that he was going to mail to some people, which would eventually change our entire concept of the world. And if Albert Einstein hadn't done that, somewhere along the line there would have come another person who would have come up with the idea, because it all exists in the field. And so we came out with a theory of relativity, which says, well, you know, Newton was good, but this is just, he wasn't really wrong, this is just an expansion to it. When I was learning mathematics, or let's say even arithmetic, I knew of numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I knew that nobody could name me the longest number on earth, because I could always name a larger number than that, and all I had to do is take whatever number you give me. Let's say you told me 13 trillion, Steve. You said 13,326,000,000,000. I could name a larger number. Just add 1 to it, and you could keep doing that until you go to infinity plus 1, and then you become totally confused. I used to think that, you know, you can prove that 3 is equal to 5 because they have in geometry something that says things that are equal to the same things are equal to one another. That means if 6 times 0 is equal to 0, and 2 times 0 is equal to 0, that means 6 is equal to 2, which when I discovered that in my, I don't know what grade I was in, but when I did discover that, and I was so happy, and I thought I'd tell my teacher about it, he said, yeah, if that were correct, you would be absolutely right, and you'd be a genius. But in mathematics, division by zero isn't permitted. It's not done. And I thought, oh, the law again. And so there are laws and laws. And if we know these things, and if we can understand that sometimes they work one way or the other, that Einstein's theory, his Einsteinian theories of relativity, and by the way, it didn't stay there. Right now we have physicists who are saying, well, Einstein was a little bit off here and a little bit off there, and if we refine it by adding this to it, it becomes more accurate. And then a century from now, let's say these scientists who discover something a little different, add it to our wealth of knowledge. By the way, we can never add to it, it's already there, we can only become aware of it. But one or two centuries from now, when we are all dematerializing, dematerializing or traveling by thought, we'd look back and say how crude we were in the 20th and 21st century, and we'd forget all about it. Do you know there's a whole generation that doesn't know what it is to be like without a cell phone? I mean, they were born with a thing. And when you try to explain to them that there was a time where there was nothing like a cell phone, in fact, there are still people who remember when there were just a black and white TV. So things change. We discover, we become more aware, and as we do that within the morphogenic field, we will be able to use tools, brighter, simpler tools, to make our lives better.
I think that is outstanding, and I'm going to look forward to that bright future. I'm also going to look forward to learning more about the morphogenic field.
I'll be happy to talk about it. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, John.